Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Thank you again for tuning in to another episode to listen to some conversations with conjurers. These are always fun conversations that I just love having, and I hope that you enjoy the ride and learn something along the way as well. Well, this week's episode is brought to you again by the Friends of the Magic Word. If it wasn't for people who give their financial donations and pledges to this podcast, I don't know how we would keep on going. We thank you guys, each and every one of you, for every dollar that you have pledged or have donated. And if you're interested in knowing how that you could become a Friend of the Magic Word and also get a few cool perks along the way, be sure to check it out on how you can become a Friend of the Magic Word by just going to themagicwordpodcast.com, and you'll see a tab there where that you can click and get more information. I just was reminded this last week, by the way, that the video that's on there is a little bit dated. That's well before I had a beard and my hair was gray. But the intent and all the information is just as valid as it was many years ago when I had recorded that. So please go take a look. And it's only about a 3-minute video. Actually, it's kind of funny to look at me now, I guess, or look at me of what I look like back then. But anyhow, thank you guys very much for your patronage and pledging and for your support and for tuning in every week just to listen. I thank each and every one of you, as I said. Well, this week we're going to be having a delightful conversation with a gentleman up in Minnesota. And what was interesting about this podcast is not only what he has to say, but also about how this came about. Dan Witkowski is the president and owner, proprietor, creator of MagicCom, which is a company that works with marketing strategies for large corporations. And he has done so much for so many different companies, including Coca-Cola and Campbell Soup, and as well as creating a couple and producing a couple of halftime shows for the Super Bowl back in 1988 and 1989. This week's episode, I think, as I said, was kind of interesting because it was actually recorded while I was in my car. Yeah, that's true. This is not the first time I've done that, so it is not without precedence. I have already done this once before whenever that I had a conversation with Jessica Jane Peterson, and that was a lot of fun. Well, this was out of necessity, as was that. In fact, the conversation that I had set up on Skype with Dan Witkowski had to happen at a certain time because of his schedule and everything else was going on, but the power was out and my Wi-Fi was out, so I had to travel to a nearby parking lot of a grocery store and use their local Wi-Fi. Well, the link was fine. It wasn't so much of the Wi-Fi so much as it just, you can kind of hear just that obviously I'm sitting inside my car and holding a microphone and I've got my laptop in my lap as I'm carrying on this Skype conversation. And I'm sure if anybody was driving by or parking near me, they probably wondered what the heck I was doing over there. But nevertheless, I knew the parking lot would be the best place to go, and particularly for a grocery store, because regardless of whatever was happening with the power, that they would have a generator just to keep their cold foods cold and their freezer section and lights on, etc. Well, anyhow, I think that you're going to be enjoying this. It's a really interesting conversation. Also, another thing that right off the bat, I mentioned that he was on the cover of the Magic Magazine, and I was in error, actually, that the magazine I was referring to was, of course, Magic Magazine that he was in. I believe it was February 2014. On the cover of that one, though, was Steve Valentine. But the cover where he was on Magic Magazine was for Genie Magazine, which was back in August of 1988, which would have been after he had already done the first Super Bowl halftime. The title of this episode, I refer to Dan Witkowski as a serial genius, kind of a play on words, because if you remember seeing some magic tricks on the backs of some of the General Mills cereal boxes, well, he's the guy. He's the one in his company who had put those together, and probably has inspired a whole generation of magicians by seeing those tricks on the backs of boxes before kids went to school, and could be you. That's why I think that you're going to enjoy this particular episode with my friend Dan Witkowski here on The Magic Word.
Today I've
chat with me, a guest from Minnesota. This is someone who owns his own company, Magicom, and you may have seen him perhaps on the cover of Magic Magazine and other places then as well. He's been in business for well over four decades, and golly, he's got to be close to my age, actually. He'd been around for a while, and not only has been involved with Magic, but also with Magic Creations, including halftime shows for the NFL, and also designing the backs of cereal boxes and working with multinational corporations as well as television and everything. There are a ton of things that we can talk about with this most creative gentleman. And I've spoken with him a time or two whenever we've been at Abbott's Get Together in Colton, Michigan. So please welcome my friend, Mr. Dan Witkowski. Hey there, Dan.
Hey, Scott. How are you?
I am fantastic.
Thanks to the listeners.
I'm so glad that we finally got a chance to chat.
Well, you know, the only thing I'm a little confused about is you said close to your age. Well, I've been in business 44 years, but I'm only 28. So
you're going backwards. That out.
Hey, what can I say? Can you blame me?
No. Well, so that means that you're closer to my age of 27, I guess.
That's right. I always look up to my elders.
Why, thank you, sir.
Okay, enough of that nonsense. Shall we move on?
Yeah, there are so many things I said that I really like to chat about. What year was that, by the way, that was you were on the cover of Magic Magazine? That must have been, they've been out of business for a number of years, at least 10 years.
A couple of years. Yeah, they did a story, I think, on one of the anniversaries of the Super Bowl show. We actually did a couple of Super Bowl shows for the NFL back-to-back. They brought us in to reorganize the opening ceremonies and made that into a show quite similar to the halftime show. And actually, from a magical standpoint, that was probably a better show. We did a big salute to Bob Hope, and there was a vaudeville segment with Houdini and blah, blah, blah. So it was quite a grand spectacle.
Well, I remember there was one that Harry Blackstone Jr. had done some years ago, and he was using some big cards and big illusions and trying to make that go. And I don't recall that was quite the spectacle that they were hoping for, at least in my opinion. Were you involved with that one at all?
No, I was not. That was at the Orange Bowl, but Harry called me the day of our big show and left a message on our voicemail to say, I'm the only person who knows what you're about to go through. But, you know, in fairness to Harry, that was a situation where they had a lot of amateur people with good intents. And Harry was the only professional, and they needed a bit more rehearsal, but that wasn't Harry's fault. So, yes, that was quite a show.
Well, yep, that's the best way of putting it. It was quite a show, and I think that you can still find that on YouTube, probably going back and looking at that. Now, when you were involved with the Super Bowl, did you pitch that, or did it come from a sponsor who said, hey, we would like for Magicom to come in and do this, or did the NFL come to you, or how did that happen to come about?
Well, a quick story. My first year in college, I had a marketing class, and we had to create a marketing plan for a fictitious company. Well, I was about to start my company, so I thought we would do, you know, the business plan around that. And part of the plan was a 30-second commercial in the Super Bowl. Well, the professor gave me a C on that particular program, and I stuck in my craw, you know, how those things happen. And so we actually decided to pitch the NFL a number of years later on the idea of doing a halftime show. I mean, if we couldn't buy a commercial, we thought, well, if they gave us the time and the value of that time, needless to say, is unbelievably expensive. So we went and did the show, and my professor, Dr. Mark Ludlow, who I'm still in contact with this day, actually went back and changed my transcript about 20 years later.
What a story.
That's the best part of the story. Yes, that was great.
Did he give you an A then? Went from a C to an A?
He went from a C to an A, but I think that's only because he wanted tickets on the 50-yard line. Even though the show, we would have liked to have done a lot of things differently in hindsight, we've coasted off that for years because But fortunately, we work with a lot of large companies, and the first thing is they say is, well, you're a small company. How do we know you'll deliver for us? And we refer to the NFL credits, and that's kind of our instant in. So it's never held us back in any way. So I'm rather fortunate.
Yeah, I would think that that would just be, it's like, that's all you have to say, you know, that that's the biggest stage in the world that has the most eyes on it all over the world, you know, who are watching the Super Bowl. You know, I was the Super Bowl magician when we had the Super Bowl here in Houston, and that has helped me, like on my website and other people saying, wow, you know, that if the NFL and the Super Bowl like him to do close up and kind of what I was doing, that gave me a lot more credibility, you know. And so I think that you have something that has that kind of notoriety that, yeah, it can carry you. So what year was that, by the way, then, too, or years that you've done that?
Let's see. We did Super Bowl 22 and 23, so that would have been 88 and 89. Mm-hmm. The 88 show was a great show. We had, Lucille Ball, George Burns, Milton Berle, Dorothy L'Amour, Bob Hope himself, and many, many more. I think we had a cast of 2,000 in that show on the field itself. So it was really quite a spectacle.
So you were making them magically appear, I guess, and then they would do a little comedy piece or what?
Well, they did pieces for us, but most of the production on the field is just, you know, moving bodies around. The great thing on working on such a large canvas is, you know, 200 people can fall over and you'd never see them fall over when you have 2,000 on the field. So there's a lot of action, a lot of movement, and there was quite a bit of magic in that particular production as well, because of Hope's career, Bob Hope's career in vaudeville and movies and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So it was quite the spectacle.
Sure.
So,
did Bob Hope like magic, and the other people, were they involved? I mean, were they kind of enamored by magic and kind of like this, or were they hard to work with?
You know, probably the biggest thrill was Lucille Ball, and mm-hmm. we got into quite a discussion about her days when she appeared with Orson Welles and the Mercury, I believe
theater.
The Mercury Theater, yes,
right.
That particular magic show, and she kept on talking about doing the broom suspension with him and having to wear, shall we say, just a difficult contraption.
Yes.
the listeners will know what that
yes,
was.
Yes, yes.
And even though it was probably 40 or 50 years before that, she still had great memories of that. And that was the exciting part to talk about with her and George Burns. And, you know, they all had their connections to magic because, you know, many of them came up through vaudeville.
That's true.
Barbara Eden didn't, but we had Jim Henson and the Muppets. And, I mean, it was really a great, fun show.
Well, now, how could people see in the stands? I assume that there were tens of thousands of people just, you know, watching. And so I assume that there are big screens that they could see, as opposed to, you know, now, of course, they're just big spectacles with music and fireworks and lots of dancers and everything like that. But at the time, what was that like?
Well, it unfolded on the field, and of course you rehearse for weeks and weeks beforehand. However, you're rehearsing in sections, you know, the first 2 minutes here and the next, 8 minutes there. And so it's all in pieces. And until I think it's the Friday before we would do our dress rehearsals, you didn't know if you knew you had sections, but you didn't know if people would exit properly and enter properly. And we thought we could have a big train wreck on our hands. And luckily we didn't. That unfolded, the way it was supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
The only problem was on Super Bowl Sunday. Well, first of all, I got in the middle of a little husband and wife tete-a-tete in Bob Hope's hotel suite with Bob Hope and his wife. His wife wanted to be said that, sitting in a certain section, Bob wanted to be in another section, and Mrs. Hope turned to me and said, "Dan, what do you think?" So that's not an envious position to be in, tell you.
To be an arbitrator between Mr. and Mrs. Hope, yeah.
And then on the Sunday of the show, Bob called me, Mr. Hope called me and said he was going to do a local TV show. And I said, well, Bob, we have your limousine all set to take you to the stadium. Traffic is going to be crazy, blah, blah, blah. And so he just said, well, fix it. And so, of course, we had to shut down the lane of the highway, have a police escort. And I think he loved that, actually. And he was in the stadium in time for the show. But, you know, there are all of those nail biters that you don't anticipate. But it's part of the life of the producer. It can hack years off your life with something like that. So,
well, you said you did it back to back then also. So did you learn a lot, I guess, from the first year? Was the second year a little bit tighter, or what?
Well, it was tighter, but the second year we had a major change. In the last couple of months, what happened is we had proposed one particular show. And as you know, Scott, doing a magic show, especially when that's televised, you need to keep cameras. If you're showing the box empty, you need to keep the camera on the box so the audience doesn't think somebody, you know, sneaks in the back.
Right.
Well, we had proposed an interactive element, and at the last moment, Coca-Cola came in and said, say, we'd really like to do blah, blah, blah. And what blah, blah, blah was, it was the first time in network television history that a show had been telecast in 3D. So Coca-Cola distributed tens of millions of 3D. Yeah, do you remember that?
I do remember that. That came with the Coke boxes. When you get a Coke six-pack or 12-pack or something.
That's correct. It was with Diet Coke. Well, in that particular process, you had to keep the cameras moving from left to right or right to left in order to show the depth of field with this particular 3D process. Well, again, with cameras in constant motion, that's really the worst thing you can do from a magic standpoint. And so from the standpoint of, you know, being a magic spectacle, it wasn't up to our wishes and standards. However, in terms of awareness, because of the 3D effect, it was covered internationally by the press, and we have volumes in our office. I think it will fill the top of like five filing cabinets of articles from all over the world talking about the 3D process. So it was a great gimmick for Coke. It sold at the time, that was the record amount of Diet Coke at a not particularly good time of the year for soft drinks, which is, you know, after the holidays and when it's cold out in most parts of the world.
Yeah, when you're not normally thinking of buying a cold soda or something. Yeah, as I said, I remember buying that, and my parents did. Well, see, wouldn't that have been in the 80s?
Oh, you were the one.
Yeah.
You were the one. Okay.
I bought several.
Thank you. So now you can buy the glasses on eBay and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, we don't talk about the content of the show as much, but we just kind of go, yes, we're the ones who did that, blah, blah, blah. And then we move on.
Right. So after the second year, I guess they decided to kind of move on to something else. I mean, they'd kind of done magic and been there, done that, and they went on from there.
Yes. Yeah. But that kind of opened a door for us. Even though I've been a magician since I was five, or, you know, started engaging with magic then, it's taken us off into a lot of different directions, all still tied to magic. We got a call shortly after that second project from British Airways, actually their ad agency in London, and they wanted us to produce a commercial with 10,000 people in it. And I said, but why would you want 10,000? This is really before a lot of computer animation and CGI type stuff. And they said, well, because the client is British Airways and they can afford to, and we'll probably win awards for it. So I kind of laughed, and we would send via fax back in the day, back and forth storyboards, and finally we produced the spot. It was you can still find it on YouTube, but it has 10,000 people in it. No magic per se. The magic was keeping all of the 10,000 people together and moving and all of that, but it was shot all over the world, and it was first done as a 90-second spot. which is virtually unheard of nowadays. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you start to build a reputation for being, you know, a general and moving masses of people around.
Well, did it win a Clio?
It's won a number of awards. It may have won a Clio, but I will tell you this. Somebody from the agency told me that for as much paid airplay they had in various markets throughout the world, they had an equal amount of free advertising because it was winning, you know, various awards and all of that. It was a great project to work on. But most of our stuff is a little closer in on magic than that in particular. But I should say, years ago, when I was a kid, Francis and Jay Marshall published a series of books called The Success Book.
Or sure. There were three of them, right?
Volume one, three. Yes, exactly. And I remember reading those books, getting them in high school, and wanting to do everything on there because it was the non-traditional stuff that, you know, most magicians do. I mean, everything from designing parade floats to products to books to, you know, and you could still have your career as a magician, but it could take you in many different directions. And I love that concept. And that's really how we started our company in the late 70s, doing what we do.
Wow, that's interesting. And as you say, once that you kind of get a brand, then people are going to want you. Yeah, when you started in the 70s, and then you probably had built up to that, obviously, in the 80s, a little at a time. And so
Well, I was fortunate in that I had a decent career as a magician, but the fact is I wasn't a great magician. I leaned more towards the comedic type of thing and illusions. But even then, I was not, you know, I was not going to compete with, back in the day, Doug Henning or David Copperfield or those fellows. I seem to recall in the late 70s, David Copperfield called me. I think I was still at my parents' home at the time, and we were buying illusions for theme park shows we were doing throughout the country. And he wanted to know, you know, our experience with different builders and that type of thing. And needless to say, you know, he's been a phenomenal success. He's a creative genius, and you know, and that was right for him. But I feel the creative side that we've applied magic to, that works for us. And it's been a fun ride. It's been very exciting.
Well, now, did you have a background in radio and television, in marketing and advertising there in Minnesota University?
Yes. At the University of Minnesota, I was in what they called the University College. So I was allowed to put together my own program, if you will. And it was a combination of advertising, marketing, radio, TV. And as I was going to the university, I was fortunate that I had a job at the local CBS affiliate, WCCO TV, here in Minneapolis. That's the station that fictitiously Mary Tyler Moore worked at, and that was in the same era. However, she didn't work at the station, but would come in often to do, you know, promo spots and that type of thing, maybe once a year, once every 2 years. Mm-hmm. And that was a great experience and learning from, you know, the TV background. They allowed me to produce a show on Houdini, which I think aired one Halloween. And then we did another magic special, which I hope is not on YouTube. And it was very, very early in my career, but great fun to do. And you learn, you know, you write the scripts, you get everything set, you get the costumes, you work with the art director on the sets, and, you know, and it's a local production. But still, I'm so grateful that so many people took a chance on us in the early days. And that, you know, gives you the inspiration.
Well, that's the reason I want to talk with you. We have so much in common, I believe, you know, different directions our lives have taken us, however, that because my background was that I have a major in journalism in the School of Advertising with a minor in radio and television, with the intent I always wanted to write, direct, and produce TV commercials was kind of where I was going. And I really wanted to work with an ad agency. It was difficult to get into an agency. I always felt like, you know, when I was trying to get in, you had to know somebody, and I didn't, you know, I was the president of our advertising fraternity from Southern Illinois University, but anyhow, had a lot of background, and it just didn't work, and I ended up working for a while in advertising for our newspaper, but anyhow, kind of got spun off and did some other things then, but nevertheless, it was, it's always so, fascinated me.
But the journalism career has helped you all of these years, and still today.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely. And one of the things, too, I think that is interesting about what we have in common with our interest in advertising is that advertising is much like magic from the standpoint that you are trying to convince someone, like in sales, that what I'm trying to show you is the best there is. You know, that everything has a few negative things that you don't want to see, and so you don't let them see that. So you kind of disguise that a little bit, and it's a little bit of subterfuge, but you're trying to sell the positive sides of it. And advertising also is a lot what magicians need to do in order to promote yourselves and everything. So anyhow, I think there are a lot of crossovers and similarities that so it's helped me, you know, with my career.
It is the continuum, and it's getting somebody's attention and trying to captivate their attention and making them want to see what you are talking about. Mm-hmm. And it's really using those techniques, and magicians have used those techniques in so many areas over the years. I was having dinner with a friend and his wife, and his wife is a advisor for the National Foundation of the Arts. And she said, you know, you magicians should really take back ownership of what you have developed so much over the years. And she was referring to, like, Georges Méliès, the famous motion picture producer, did all of the filmmaker who did all of the special effects, and you know how Disney is known as the Magic Kingdom, and they have all of their magic. Well, yes, but a lot of their techniques have their origins in the world of magic.
Yes,
you know, even in product development where we work. There are so many connections to magic. I know it was the Davenport brothers in England. I believe it was the Davenport brothers who had the first
Spirit Cabin.
No, it was a pay toilet.
I forgot about that. You're exactly right on that. Mm-hmm.
Yes, they obtained a patent on that. And the 1800s, and there are so many connections to magic, and we're still trying to look at those from different perspectives and marry non-traditional forms of business with the medium of magic, not forcing it, but it comes naturally. We have a product line that we developed just recently under the Brilliant brand. Brilliant is a name that we've been able to trademark. There is a product, you know, those little labels that they have on fruits and vegetables that, sure. You know, they bruise the fruit as you take them off, or kids will stick the labels onto,
pineapples or bananas and things like that, or apples, that they have those little stickers, you mean?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And people hate those stickers. There are websites developed those. So one of our clients asked us if we could develop an alternative. And we looked at inkjet printing right on the fruit and vegetables.
Right.
Product sold at magic stores years ago called Dissolvo. And it was like flash paper in that flash paper, obviously, you ignite and poof, it's gone with no ash. Dissolvo, you can place it in water and it dissipates. I'm told bookies would use it to get rid of their list. Quickly, if they had to, if they were being
the
FBI was getting
right.
So we reformulated a paper like that, or a substrate like that, made it organic, made the adhesive on it one way. So, you know, some people will go into a Kroger store, peel off the label from the least expensive apples, and put them on the most expensive apples to save 4 or 5 cents. So we did a one-way adhesive. Once you take it off, you can't put it back on something. And then we infused that with like a citric acid, which is a lemon juice, lime juice, and like a powdered vinegar. So as you rinse the fruit, the label comes off, the adhesive is dissipated, but it releases the citric acid and vinegar to cleanse the fruit and remove any bacteria or pathogens that might be
used
in the growing process.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. And without having a background in magic and familiar with that type of thing, you know, we never would have come upon that type of thing. So,
huh. Well, it sounds like you've got engineers working for you. I mean, scientists as well. I mean, it's not just creative people, you know, who are imagineers, I guess, as Disney would call them, but you've actually got people who are scientists working with that.
You know, that's a very appropriate name. We're a teeny tiny company, but we have always patterned ourselves after Disney's Imagineering because they solve problems, usually mm-hmm. very creatively, but they have people from a lot of different disciplines, and you know, they're advising and things. Today we were working on another project for the Mayo Clinic, and you think magic and healthcare, how can that be? Well, if you take two disciplines that are not connected, it opens up the world of other possibilities mm-hmm. that most, you know, don't look at. So that's really, we have a lot of fun with that. And it's serious.
I can see what you're talking about. You know, something that are two completely different disciplines that you can bring together and merge.
Well, Scott, you know, that's exactly the point. We tend to think as magicians that, you know, we do the impossible. Well, we do it through means that are not maybe as legitimate as we make them out to be as a form of entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're really not making the girl levitate, but we believe that there are many ways of doing something. And so if you take that basic approach that anything is possible, it does allow for a lot of different opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
And so... And it allows you to look at things a little differently. And so whether it's packaging, you know, packaging is a graphic art, but yet on the same token, everybody wants to make it seem like, and perhaps this is deception, but it is used frequently. There are certain colors and certain designs that make something appear larger. We all know from our optical illusion
sure.
experiments. Then, you know, then it is. So you might seem like you're getting more in a particular package with a certain color scheme or design.
Right.
So those are the principles we try to apply. So,
well, that is a natural transition to talking about how you design packages for General Mills with tricks on the back of the packages and everything then, too. That was, I assume that was after the Super Bowl experience.
We started on that, I believe, in the 70s. And but a little background on that, the thing that got me into magic, of course, was in the 1960s, as many people of our vintage got into magic. It was from Mark Wilson's Magic Land of Alakazam.
Right.
And he had a balancing Rebo trick on the back of one of the Kellogg cereal boxes.
Frosted Flakes.
Oh, I remember having... Yes, exactly. I have a signed box from Mark that's encased in Lucite on my office wall.
That's great.
And but we have done many, many magic premiums. And one of the great things, experiences I've had, is sometimes somebody will come up to me at a magic convention and say, "Well, you might not know this, but you got me involved in magic because of such and such,
mm-hmm.
Either a video that we've done or magic premiums that we've done for hotels and fast food companies and just a variety of companies." And I think even though those are not necessarily the most expensive magic tricks and all,
right.
They have inspired people. Somebody from my staff a couple of years ago tried to add up all of the different things that we've done. And while we don't have an exact number, they figure it's close to 2 billion magic tricks that we've done since.
Billion with a B?
Yeah, 2 billion with a B. And so,
wow.
In different languages and various things. Now, again, these are things that might cost pennies or, you know, 25 cents or thereabouts. either put in a cereal box or on a box or, you know, with packaging in some ways. We also have a kids book imprint with Random House called Abracadazzle Press. Mm-hmm. And it's not strictly magic, but there is a good deal of magic as a part of that. So really, whatever the medium is, we like to get people involved thinking magic and thinking things. But what has changed in recent years is, even though there's still a desire to get or create something magical, it's not always seen in the form of a trick. We've done numerous programs with Star Wars, and while the effects have been magical, yet you wouldn't see them as a magic trick per se. They might involve mirrors or holograms or that type of thing. So they are magical, but not necessarily a trick oven by itself.
Gotcha.
Okay. I talk a lot.
Well, no, that's perfect.
Sorry about that.
I'm glad you remind me of Mark Randall. Were you at Magic Live when Mark Randall was speaking? He was used to be with Adobe. He's the one who created the PDFs and everything. You know what I'm talking about? Brilliant creative
gentleman.
No,
I don't.
You need to go back and listen to one of the podcasts I had done with him. And he was, in fact, Stan Allen had called me because, again, he was part of Magic Live and one of the presenters and talking about creating. And it was just a phenomenal short little TED Talk kind of thing he did. But the point is that Stan said, you know, I enjoyed that podcast because that your guest talked more than you did. Because typically, you know, I'm talking a lot. So thank you. I'm glad that you are talking a lot. This is great. So what was one of the more challenging things that you had? Or what was, as far as, like, on a cereal box? I mean, that or putting something inside but still having enough room for the cereal? I mean, what's been one of the most challenging experiences you'd had?
Well, there's kind of a funny story. A few years ago, well, actually, it was quite a few years ago, maybe 20 or 25, I was in France with my wife, and we were going to leave the next morning, and we were in Paris and walking down the street. I think we had seen, you know, the production shows that might feature magicians at the Folies Bergères or the Lido show, etc. Right. But we were walking past the Lido, and I saw something in the window, and it was a little cube, and it was not a magic trick. It was just like a paperweight, and you looked at it from one angle, and you saw a top hat floating in it, and you looked at it from the other angle, and the top hat would vanish. And so, again, not really a magic trick, but a novelty, but having its origins in magic. And I said to my wife, if you're willing to stay in France one more day, I'd we can do that. I didn't tell her it was over a magic trick. That's one thing I learned early on.
Smart man.
At least she could go shopping. And, of course, I returned to the Lido and bought this little novelty. Well, there was a patent number on it. And it was from the Tenyo company that we know in Japan,
right,
as having created some great, you know, plastic effects. Well, kind of end of story for a moment. We would produce a lot of premiums and toy type things for other companies. We would do various custom books or Random House or the Western Publishing, the publisher of Little Golden Books. And there was a company called Applause, which was based in L.A., and they were doing the second series of, or the prequels, the Star Wars movies. Mm-hmm. And Scott, I hate to admit this, my kids have seen Star Wars, they have the DVDs, on and on and on. I've never seen a Star Wars movie beginning to end. Not that I'm against it, I just... It's just not my particular thing, although we've done oodles of promotions.
Sure.
And I know, I know a lot of the characters are the older characters.
I'm surprised. Well, I would think that to get to know that product better, that you would have done some research to kind of know what they're talking about.
Well, we have a lot of books in our library, and we do. It's like I probably have seen enough of the movies,
yeah,
but in like 2 minute and 3 minute clips that I know a lot of the things. Anyway.
Well, tell me, have you seen Harry Potter? Have you seen the Harry Potter series?
I've seen a couple of the movies, yes, and okay. I've enjoyed them thoroughly. It's not that I have anything against it. It's okay. Just there's only so many hours.
Oh, sure.
So the crazy thing is we get a call from this company, Applause, and they want something magical, but it can't be a magic trick, and it has to appeal equally to boys and girls and mm-hmm. and adults if possible, and this ridiculous list of things on their wish list. And the whole time that they're calling me, I've got this little cube on my desk, and I'm looking at it, and this is, like I say, a couple of years later. Well, we contacted Tenyo, we licensed the idea, and they allowed us to produce a thing. And the cube ultimately has Yoda on one side, Darth Vader on the other side, and it looks like Yoda transforms into Darth Vader and vice versa. You can still buy these on eBay, but we did, I think the first round was 20 million pieces. Then they repeated it with another character a few years later, the young boy who wears goggles. I'm trying to think of his name. Anakin?
Anakin Skywalker, yes.
Is that Anakin?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, okay. And then he changed to Darth Vader.
Yes.
And then they did a third one. So in total, they did about 45 million pieces. And the last one was not tied to Star Wars. It was tied to Ghostbusters. And I just found one of those on eBay. Now, mind you, these have to be manufactured for like 30 or 40 cents.
Mm-hmm.
The current one I saw on eBay is like $35.
Wow.
So it's crazy. Is it magical? Yes.
Was it Lucasfilms that had contracted? Or?
No, it was through Pepsi Cola.
Oh.
And Pepsi Cola was the exclusive licensee. So these were available at Taco Bell and KFC and all of the various restaurant chains that.
So they're kind of like the toys that were like in the Happy Meal kind of a thing.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
There's one final part of this story. When I was doing a show in New York in the early 1980s, I was doing a show at Radio City Music Hall. And I had a friend who was appearing in Sugar Babies on Broadway, Ron Lucas, a great ventriloquist.
Ventriloquist, sure.
And I used to say to him, yes, I said, Ron, you have the best looking puppets. He had a dragon that was just fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, Ron, who makes your puppets? And he says, oh, my uncle, blah, blah, blah. Then years ago, he was in my office in Minneapolis, and he saw one of these cubes with Darth Vader and Yoda on it. And he said, you know, my uncle has one of these on his desk. And I said, you know, does your uncle have a prop company or something? And he was kind of reluctant to say, well, then I got it out of him. Ron Lucas, his uncle was George Lucas.
Oh, you gotta be, I did not know the relationship.
That's
a great story.
So isn't that crazy? So at least
uncle
it
George.
Was on his desk. Uncle George, yes. So, you know, we all love magic.
Yeah. Well, that's
isn't
like
that
me,
crazy?
Me, you know, you were talking about earlier with Lucille Ball and doing a suspension with my uncle Orson Welles. And so whenever...
Really?
No.
He's your uncle too?
Yeah, exactly. I kind of dropped that
he's
in.
He's my godfather.
Yeah. I say that once in a while, you know, tongue in cheek, and that's kind of in passing, saying, well, Uncle Orson, and I don't remind them, they know my last name, and then somewhere down the conversation, somebody said, wait a minute, Orson Welles is your uncle? I got you.
Is it true?
No, he's not. No relation. He has, there are two E's in his name, W-E-L-L-E-S, and mine is just W-E-L-L-S, so no.
Not to try to top you, Scott, but I do have an Orson Welles story.
Oh, I love him. Okay, good.
Years ago, I had John Gahn, the famous illusion
builder, right?
Building a lot of props for us. And I always wanted the light bulb cabinet that Blackstone did in the 40s, you know, where all of the light bulbs penetrate the grill. Well, mm-hmm. he built one for us. I think I only performed it once, but Harry Blackstone Jr. borrowed it on one occasion, and I said it was at John's shop just to be refurbished after Harry used it. And Orson Welles happened to be doing a movie. He always wanted to do this movie on magic. And I think he was going to do the Merv Griffin show. And he asked John if he could lease it. He says, well, it's not mine, blah, blah, blah. And so he contacted me, and I said, by all means, have him use it. So there is a video floating around with Orson Welles doing the light bulb cabinet, and that's my cabinet.
Wow.
So
what movie was that?
Yeah.
Do you remember the name of
it? I don't believe the movie was released. However, if you go on the Thayer website, the Thayer Magic website, you can see a clip of it there. So I think he was going to do it on the Merv Griffin show. He may have done that, but this film clip has aired quite a number of times. It aired once on NBC many, many years ago, and I don't think the film was actually finished. But, you know, he was quite a powerful, well, needless to say, he was an incredible actor, but he was truly a grand magician in the old style. And
he certainly loved magic and magicians and liked working with them. And I don't know that he really hung around magicians for the most part, Cary Grant was on the board of directors for the Academy of Magical Arts, for example. He would hang around the Magic Castle. I don't recall that hearing stories about Orson Welles just kind of dropping in, all the time. Johnny Carson used to be at the castle all the time, too, from what I heard. But I don't think Orson Welles really rubbed shoulders with many magicians the way that some other actors have, despite his interest.
But there are a lot of magicians who worked with him.
Sure.
I know Stan Allen, Mike Caveney, they both had the opportunity to work with him. And, it was mind-boggling. Talk about larger than life. And I don't mean that physically.
Yeah.
That's the problem I suffer from, unfortunately. What was the line? Don't ask Orson Welles to grow the Twinkies.
Exactly.
Sorry about that.
Yeah.
You could substitute my name equally.
I used to be on your Christmas card list, and because someone had told me some years ago, it said, man, that, because I had been sending out these Christmas cards for decades, that was just a picture, but somebody said, well, you need to get on Dan Wachowski's Christmas card list, because he actually has these tricks where you can cut and fold and paste or whatever, and they actually do things, or the cards. And for a few years, I was fortunate enough to be on your list, and I had received several of these, which I've kept, and I've got in my file drawers of stuff. And do you still have people who help design these Christmas cards for you?
We haven't done a magical card in quite a number of years. I think when my son finally went off to college, we stopped doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So you've not been cut from the list. I assure you of that.
Okay, so I wasn't
dropped. You were a perennial. No, you were a perennial on the list. But I'm getting the feeling it's funny because, we did it for the fun of it, and it was kind of a trademark. And we found out that a lot of people really look forward to them, supposedly.
Yeah.
And so that was quite good to know. I think my favorite was we did a little flip book one year of my daughter when she was a year old, and it was her first baby steps. And the front of the card said, presenting our most amazing magical feat. And everybody thought it was a typo because feet was spelled F-E-E-T.
Yeah,
and then they opened it up and they saw the flip book of her standing up and taking her first steps. I know, vain parents, right?
Yeah, well, that is perfect. How great is that?
So we had a lot of magical ones over the years.
You've got a lot of people who are working there in the building then for MagicCom as well. I'm sure, it's kind of, grown and gotten, large and small, depending upon the projects and things that are
sure.
constantly coming in and everything then too. So what kind of departments do you have? I mean, you do a lot of most of your things in-house. Do you ship out a lot of things or subcontract for some printing, or have you got your own printing presses and everything? Or?
Oh, no. We actually don't have a large staff and never have the 44 years we've been in business. we do, you know, grow and shrink according to the various things we're working on.
Right.
It's funny, as you go down our hallway, we have our creative apartment or our creative department. And then next to that is our accounting department. And then next to that is our creative accounting department. That's a joke, Scott.
Got it. Yeah. Creative accounting.
Yes, I get it. Sorry about that.
Yeah. But to make sure really, for tax purposes that that's just they put it off. IRS, hey, that's just a joke.
Yes. Oh, that printing press with the 20s on it. That's, you know, just a prop.
That's a prop. Yeah. Those are prop bills.
We mostly have project managers on staff. We do have, you know, a financial department, and my controller has been with me for 32 years. Mm. We have a librarian who really kind of minds our library, and I'm not the type of guy who buys first editions or that type of thing, but it's a real working library. So yeah, right, we have... Yeah. You know, a good library of magic things, but also related types of things because of our publishing business. We have, you know, everything from kids books to business books to, you know, and that's very well organized and barcoded, you know, to our unique system, because we're constantly saying, oh, we've got to learn about nanotechnology, let's say.
Or 3D printing or something like that, right.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. We just finished 3D printing. I think we have 4 3D printers. We just built a miniature of, and this is because of all of the detail with it, of a major, like a hypermarket type store. Mm-hmm. I guess it would look like a Walmart here or Target or, you know, the hypermarkets they have in Europe.
Yeah, yeah.
But the products are all specifically on the shelf by where they, you know, might actually be. And then we're using some magical techniques to bring certain aspects to life. It is, again, not traditional magic, but very magical. So you can actually have the products kind of tell their story. It's a way of competing with a lot of the online things and giving you the experience that you, you know, can't see from a product in the box.
So it's like an on-demand printing kind of thing, like for books that on-demand print?
Well, this particular thing uses projection, and it's projecting onto the products, and you probably have seen some of the projection mapping that they do on buildings and that type of thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's a very sophisticated system.
Yes.
And it takes a lot of mathematical calculations. Well, this eliminates the need for the mathematical calculations, and yet we can project onto something. So we might have a platter that you might have, you know, on your table for Thanksgiving, and there's a turkey on it, and then the turkey morphs to some other types of food, or a lobster, or this, or that. So you can show the versatility of some products.
Kind of augmented
and
reality.
And literally bring them to life. Yeah, exactly. But you can experience it in 3D right in the store. So it's a combination of 2D and 3D.
Gotcha.
And yeah, for years we worked with Target, and they're based here in Minneapolis. And now we're usually a one client company. We only work with one client in a particular industry, but we are expanding a little bit beyond that for some of these particular ventures.
Well, you said earlier about Coca-Cola, then also Pepsi-Cola. So you had a couple different competitors there, it sounds like. What would you say would be one of the most fun things that you, I mean, in the decades you've been working, that you have, that you really enjoyed doing, or the thing that you feel like, you know, this really was it? I love doing this.
You know,
most proud
it's of. Probably one thing we're doing now, in that it's not so much about selling a product or that type of thing, but we're working with the Mayo Clinic here in Rochester, Minnesota. They also have operations in Arizona and Florida. And they're, needless to say, a world-renowned medical facility. But what we're working with them is very magical, but you wouldn't expect it to be a magic experience. For example, nobody likes to go to a hospital. I mean, you know that, and sure. we all know that. But if you could go into a hospital room and all of a sudden that particular room didn't have all of the technology on the floors and the beeping and the equipment, if they were hidden the walls but could be there in a moment's notice, and if the room itself seemed like your bedroom at home with whatever pictures on the wall you might have in your own room. So to experience what you have at home, or if I were to ask you, what's your favorite, what are your top 10 favorite restaurants that you've ever been to? I can guarantee not one of them is a restaurant or food service at a hospital. But if you could bring that experience so that it's, you know, it's really about making people more comfortable and creating that experience. And in some cases, it uses a lot of magic techniques in, again, hiding that equipment in the room and making it much, much more comfortable and adaptable. And that's how we're applying magic and the illusions and effects in a medium that really has not been tapped into before.
Wow, that does sound completely different. I love it. I mean,
yeah, that's a very
there are more than just the project. Sights and sounds, but also the smells. I would think, you know, that you could create some aromas that would remind you of a restaurant as opposed to the sterile hospital smells, you know.
Well, even to the point that if you're not in the medical facility for dietary issues, let's say, it's the ability to say, you know, my favorite meal is such and such, and being able to have that served to you and also presented to you in a novel way. Does it take more time? Yes. Is it more expensive? Yes. But how can you build upon that and simplify a lot of the steps so it's not just what everybody else, you know, throughout the hospital is dining on, and making that experience magical? And as magicians, I think we really have an edge in knowing a lot of that and how to present things and how to make them more engaging and creating that experience. And I think, you know, those are some of the things that magicians really have the talents that they can explore in other areas.
Right. I mean, you're tapping into something right there that is completely different, that is brand new and everything then too. Is that something that you had an idea and then approached Mayo Clinic, or did somebody come to you and say, you know, we're thinking about trying to change this up, and then, you know, with an idea, and then you kind of put on the thinking cap, and then, in other words, I'm trying to understand, what is your muse? What is how do you create? I mean, not just that, but other things. Whenever people would come to you, or you go to them, I mean, or you go to bed at night and you kind of play with things in your mind, wake up in the morning and say, hey, this would be an idea. I need to contact XYZ Corporation.
Well, sometimes it happens that way, but more often than not, it starts in a totally unrelated product or project. In the case of Mayo Clinic, we had developed something for Walmart, which is, do you remember the magic trick Attaboy?
Oh,
Abbott
sure.
Sissel,
sure.
The version of it. And sure. So it's an 18-inch tall little wooden placard of a bellhop. That's a card trick and blah, blah, blah. For some reason, you know, every magician loves the look of that particular thing.
It's like a little Philip Morris kind of a butler kind of a guy, you know, with a pillbox hat. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. And so we were playing with a projection technique that we have where we can project a human being on a plexiglass form that has some special film on it. Well, that became a directional thing that we created called Whitney. And because it was developed for Walmart, Whitney was Sam Walton, the founder of Walmart's only granddaughter. So that's how it became Whitney. And Whitney, unlike Siri and unlike Alexa for, you know, from Amazon, is more than a voice. There's a visual component as well as two screens. So we developed it as a wayfinding thing. If you go into Walmart and say, do you sell Jell-O? Whitney would say yes, and here's how to find it, and here's how to get there. And she would show it, you know, what aisle it is and what shelf it is, blah, blah, blah. Well, the Mayo Clinic happened to be in one day, and they said, wow, they could use a thing like that because they have so many guests who are either from foreign countries or don't speak English or might not even have a smartphone. And so we premiered a version of this at in Rochester a couple of years ago. And then they asked us to work on such and such. And that's usually how things evolve. It starts with one project. And in that case, we can actually say it started with an attaboy from Abbott's. Isn't that bizarre?
That is. Yeah, it's kind of funny. All from one small thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, so often, and yet we will develop things on our own that, I mean, we have a thing for Coca-Cola now, and it's a way to do animation and animated image around the 360-degree circumference of a Coca-Cola bottle.
Oh, okay.
And it's a very, it's not a lenticular lens. You may remember those as,
sure,
you know, the little linky blinky rings as kids, but it's a way of doing full animation around the perimeter. And so we would like to tie that into the Olympics, which not the next summer's Olympics, I guess it's next summer now,
yeah,
in Japan, but rather the Winter Olympics that will follow it, with collectible Coke bottles featuring all the different sports. So again, magic, but in a different format.
Kind of reminds me a little bit of magic in another format, and then I'll start to wrap up over here. Of the 19 Crimes wine that has an AR label that you would put your telephone or your cell phone,
yes,
on that, in, and it will come to life and it will talk to you or whatever. And there are wine bottles and things like that that kind of come to life using AR technology. So
exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And can you think of a better criminal than a magician to put on a bottle of wine?
Good point. That's right.
Scott, we could both be behind bars, but not the bars we want to be behind.
I want to be behind a bar where they could serve me a martini.
I'll drink to that.
Well, listen, then, I thank you for your time. And as we wrap up, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word, Dan. And so I would like to know, I always ask my guests at the end about, what is your philosophy of life? What is your magic word or phrase?
You know, it's the classic line, the glass is always half full. Sometimes it's champagne. Sometimes it's water. Sometimes it's battery acid. But you know what? There's always something to look forward to. And, you know, you just have to, you know, you have to get through whatever you're getting through that is bothering you at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, there'll be something good down the line. The best is yet to come.
The best is yet to come. I like that a lot. Dan, thank you very much. You've just been a wonderful guest, and just with some great stories. And man, what a life that you have lived so far. And I wish you another 40 plus years with the company then as well. So this would be great. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Scott. We'll see if we can get Orson on his headstone to change the spelling of his name the same way you spell it. Fair enough?
Fair enough with me. So with the Magic Word Podcast,
thank you.
That was Dan Witkowski. This is Scotty out. Wow, another delightful conversation. Thank you so much, Dan. I appreciate your time that you gave me in order to talk about some of the accomplishments that you and MagicCom have had, and I look forward to a lot of really great things out of you. I mean, you've only done this for 40 years. You got a lot of more time in front of you. So congratulations. Well, thank you again, listeners, for tuning in and listening to this week's episode. If you'd like to know more information about what's going on and what's coming up, let me suggest that if you have not already subscribed to the Podlet, when you go to themagicwordpodcast.com, you will see a little pop-up that'll probably come on your screen. It'll say subscribe to the pod letter. If not, then there's a place on a tab on the side there or somewhere on the screen, whichever kind of instrument that you're using, whether it's going to be a phone or a tablet or a PC or laptop, whatever, that you'll be a place that you can drop down, see how that you can subscribe to the pod letter. And each week I will give you a notice as to who's going to be on this week and who's coming up next week, and also a recommendation from the archives of who you may have overlooked that you need to go back and listen to, someone that I really think would be of interest. And so you can subscribe quite easily, and there's not a lot to the newsletter. It's not going to take much of your time and take up much in your inbox then either, but it's just a lot of fun. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember that regardless of where you are right now, the best is yet to come. This is Scotty out.